which hopefully I'll explain enough so that you can understand. If you're not familiar with Adventist history, that's okay. I'll explain this part of it enough that you should be able to learn the lesson, and it's applicable to anyone, I think, in a certain sense. So the title I put here is The Troubler of Israel, you know, and sometimes, you know, sometimes people can rattle cages. I don't know if you've ever had the privilege of doing that yourself, but maybe you remember the line from Scripture, who was the troubler of Israel? Anybody remember? Elijah, yeah, at least Ahab thought so anyhow, right? You know, Elijah didn't really, he wasn't too good with that whole designation. He kind of turned around backwards, but put it back on Ahab. But nonetheless, so we're talking about one of those kind of stories. And a footnote, or a subtitle, Why the Loud Cry Only Began. Now, this may take just a little more theoretical comprehension, so let me just explain this very briefly. When you work your way through the book of Revelation, you will come to the 18th chapter, after you finish the first 17, anyhow, you get to the 18th chapter, and there we have the prophecy of an angel descending and crying with a loud voice. And the loud cry is a term that, at least within Seventh-day Adventism and some other places, is used to designate that particular part of prophecy, which is, of course, yet future. Well, sort of. The complete fulfillment of it is yet future. And yet we'll see as we go through this that it was begun. It was begun once upon a time. Why didn't it carry on? That's the question. So we'll be looking at that. Well, let's jump on in and get the setting here a little bit. We have to, because this is a historical story, I have to give you a little background first of all. Let's see, we're starting off with these dates, October 10 through November 5, 1888. There was a ministerial institute, and the general conference session was held at Minneapolis that particular year. Now, if you've dabbled in Adventist history at all, you may recognize Minneapolis, 1888. This was a very important conference. Other names and concepts associated with this, you know, A.T. Jones and E.J. Wagner played an important role there. There was a great deal of discussion on the law in Galatians and the ten horns of Daniel chapter 7, righteousness by faith, and a lot of things. And so if you're interested or if you have, you know, gotten into that history, you may recognize this was an important occasion, okay? One aspect of that occasion that has often been overlooked is this little interesting concept here. After the meeting at Minneapolis, Dr. Kellogg was a converted man, and we all knew it. We could see the converting power of God working in his heart and life. That's interesting. Now, Dr. Kellogg would be Dr. John Harvey Kellogg, who was the medical director of what was known at the time as the Battle Creek Sanitarium. He was a physician, MD. He was one of the more famous physicians in the world, certainly in the United States. His institution received patronage from a lot of recognizable names, Henry Ford, Thomas Edison, miscellaneous senators and congressmen from Washington, D.C. President Taft, I believe, visited after he'd completed his term of office. And there were crown heads from Europe. So this was a fairly well-known guy. Now, Dr. Kellogg, after the meeting at Minneapolis, was a converted man. Well, you know, he'd grown up in the Adventist Church. He had been the medical director of the sanitarium for 12 years already. So this kind of raises an interesting question. How did everybody know he was all of a sudden converted? You know, I mean, does that mean that he stopped going to the bar, you know, and getting drunk every night? Well, no, he hadn't been doing that, you know. What was the difference? How was it that Dr. Kellogg was not just converted, but so much so that everybody knew it and they could see it? There was something obvious, okay? Well, at the risk of making this sound too simple, it boiled down to that Dr. Kellogg's conversion came in the arena of basically being nice to people. And I know that sounds really untheological, but you know, that's what Jesus was. And it's a little bit warped. It's very warped to claim to be a Christian and not be nice to people. Just reflect momentarily on all the Christian wars that have been fought and try to figure out exactly how that fits into the gospel, but anyhow, okay. So skipping over a whole bunch of interesting historical details, we're just going to accept the fact that when Dr. Kellogg was converted, he became nice to people. He started trying to help people. And that led him to an interest in some groups of people that the Bible actually has a lot to say about, specifically orphans, widows, and old folks. The people that need help, basically, okay? So, now this all ended at the, you know, near the end of 1888. Dr. Kellogg went back to Battle Creek, you know, and they could see this, it was all taking place, it was rolling out, so to speak. Kellogg was not the kind of a guy who just, you know, sat around quietly. He was a kind of a mover and a shaker type of thing. Well, it took a little while, but within about a year and a half, by the summer of 1890, Kellogg was thinking bigger plans. And in the summer of about July, early August of 1890, Dr. Kellogg happened to be up north in Michigan at Petoskey, or however it's pronounced. And he approached Ellen White, and he said, "What would you think about an orphanage? Should we have an orphanage at Battle Creek?" And she said it was a great idea. She says, we're years behind on this kind of thing. So Kellogg had, you know, now he had some confirmation in his mind. He had a goal, he had a plan. But, you know, sometimes you're ready to push on something, you got to wait till all the, you know, little pieces line up type of thing. And that was the general conference session of 1891, which is in February, okay? So he gets this idea in the summer, he talks about it, he, you know, kind of compares notes with some people, talks to Ellen White. February 1891, general conference session, this is where the big decisions are made, all the committees and all that kind of stuff, you know? And so he goes into the committee, he goes to the general conference, and he makes a motion that the church start an orphanage. He'd done some research by that time, and he knew that there were at least 400 Seventh-day Adventist orphans, just in the United States. 400, you know, there was a higher number of orphans back in those days, you know, type of thing. It was, birth rate was higher, and people were dying from tuberculosis and that kind of stuff. So he said, you know, we got at least 400 Adventist orphans out here. Most of them are not being taken care of properly. So he takes the motion to the general conference. They pass the motion. They said, okay, that's a great idea. Let's set up a committee. And they chose the guys, whoever all it was. They set up the committee. And they said, obviously, the first thing you folks need to do as the managing committee for this orphanage is to raise some funds. So you can advertise or make solicitations and appeals in the church paper. And, you know, you can go around and talk to churches and, you know, do traditional fundraising type of things to get the money together so we can start this orphanage. And they tried. But it didn't go well. A year passed. It was February 1892. And the committee sat down together to say, what are we going to do about this orphanage thing? They didn't have much money. The church collectively, so to speak, had just really not shown much enthusiasm for an orphanage. They had some money. Now, actually, it's kind of interesting. I went back and I looked to see, because they would print, you know, the back 100 years ago, they didn't mail out receipts to everybody. They didn't have tax-deductible receipts and all that kind of stuff, you know. So they would just put donations. They'd list the names and the people, you know, in the little fine print in the back of the church paper. I went and looked, and you look at the money that they had received, it was all what we would call seed money. You know, it's just, it's like recognizable names who are saying, I support this, you know. Come on, everybody, let's support this. And basically what had happened is the seed money had gone in, and it hadn't sprouted, you know. And so they had just enough money to buy a piece of property. Couldn't build a thing, but they had just enough to buy a piece of property. Now, Kellogg was really getting kind of worried about this, because it may sound like this wasn't that big of an issue, things are taking longer than we expected, no, it's okay. No, it was an issue, because even though the church had not gotten excited as a whole about an orphanage, there was one group of people who got very excited about an orphanage as soon as it was announced that there was going to be an orphanage. Anyone care to guess who would get excited about an orphanage? The orphans or the folks who were taking care of them. And they started showing up in Battle Creek on the train, often by themselves. And so Kellogg had now 20-some orphans, and he rented a little house, just a normal house, out behind the sanitarium, and he went into the director of nursing and said, excuse me, I need about 3 nurses. And he hauled them out and says, you can take care of these guys here today, you know, type of thing. So this was not an ideal situation, and Kellogg was starting to get frantic. He didn't have the money to build his orphanage. I mean, it wasn't his orphanage, but the church wasn't putting up the money to build an orphanage. What was he going to do? So Kellogg began praying for a miracle. And skipping over lots of interesting details, this is what the Lord gave him. It was known as the Haskell Home for Orphan Children. And what's interesting is the way it came about. Is that a Mrs. Carolyn Haskell came to visit someone at the sanitarium. A patient saw what they were doing, looked around, walked down to Dr. Kellogg's office one day and said, Dr. Kellogg, I think I'd like to help your work. Is there anything you need some money for? And he started in describing a fairly modest project. And she said, I was thinking of something much larger than that. And so he says, you know, we're wanting to build an orphanage. And she says, that's the kind of idea I'm looking for. It turns out that her husband, Mr. Charles Haskell, had died a year and a half or so before and left her a fair chunk of change. She was looking for something to do as a memorial to her husband. And so eventually, she put up the money for this interesting structure. If you have any misgivings in your mind as to what inflation does, try to build one of those for $30,000. I don't think you could put the windows in for $30,000. Anyhow, but that's all it costs. And every dime of that came from Mrs. Haskell. And what's interesting is that she was not a Seventh-day Adventist. She was not related to S.N. Haskell, who's a well-known Adventist minister. You may have recognized that name. No. She and her husband were Pentecost? No, not Presbyterian, I think it was. Anyhow, they weren't Adventists. She was just a good-hearted lady that says, you know, yeah, I want to help. Okay. Well, let's see. Let's bounce ahead here. Dr. Kellogg did not spend all his time working on the orphanage project. Also, in early 1892, he started what was known as the Visiting Nurses Program in Chicago, where one of the sanitarium nurses worked full-time in the worst parts of the city, doing all she could to help the poorer members of society. This program, too, paid for by a non-Adventist. What had happened is that there was a young lady who was ill. She lived in Chicago. Her father was a businessman, some sort of manufacturing business. I don't remember what it was. She ended up going to Battle Creek for treatment, and she stayed there for about 6 weeks. During that time, she very much received the care she was receiving from the nurses. But for some reason or the other, and I don't know what it was precisely, she was taken back down to Chicago for a very critical surgery. It may have been some sort of a specialized something or other. Dr. Kellogg was about the best surgeon around. Why they went back to Chicago, I don't know. It's possible there was somebody down there that specialized in this particular kind of surgery or something. I don't know. Give you an idea for whatever it's worth. There are still patients alive who had surgery performed by Dr. Kellogg, and I'm told maybe not so much anymore, but 20 years ago at least, which was, 20 years ago, it was like 50 years after Kellogg died almost, people would go in for their annual physical, and the doctor would take one look at the scar and say, yeah, Dr. Kellogg did that, didn't he? Because he could sew you up better than anybody else could sew you up. The guy was a great surgeon. Anyhow, so the girl went back down to Chicago and had the operation, but it was not successful. And on her deathbed, she made her father promise. She said, Father, as a memorial to me, I want you to put up the money to bring a sanitarium nurse from Battle Creek down to work for the poor people in Chicago. That's what I want you to do. Well, the girl died, and the father began writing letters to Kellogg. Kellogg didn't have a nurse. He wasn't ready to, what's up? He didn't have this. Wasn't on his radar screen type of thing. And so he just ignored the letters. And then they got smart. I don't know if they knew anything about Kellogg or not, but Kellogg always had a soft spot in his heart for mothers. So now mom starts writing letters. And he couldn't resist. And so he went to the sanitarium and he picked out a young lady by the name of Emily Schranz, who was the best nurse he had. I'm not positive this is a picture of Emily. I can't guarantee that. But she is definitely one of the early visiting nurses. Incidentally, you'll note that this was back in the days when nurses still knew the difference between a uniform and pajamas. Anyhow, nurses ought to wear uniforms. I just still hold to that opinion. But anyhow, so Emily went down to Chicago, and they put her down in what was known as the brewery, variously known as Hell's Half Acre, although it was significantly larger. And this was a rough place. This was a very rough place. She reported having to often stop. She was trying to get to the fifth floor of a tenement, and on the third floor they were in the middle of a knife fight, and she had to break that up so she could get through to the upper stories, type of thing. So it was quite an interesting situation. So Kellogg had started the orphanage, paid for by Mrs. Haskell, and he'd started the visiting nurses program that was paid for by this Chicago businessman. In early 1892, Kellogg had floated another idea. He'd written an article, I believe. I haven't yet been able to find an original of this, but I've got one retyped copy of an article that's attributed to Dr. Kellogg as February of 1892. That was certainly earlier than I have any other record of this. But anyhow, in February of 1892, about the same time as the committee was getting together to talk about the orphanage and didn't have any money, Kellogg wrote this article, I think, about what he called Christian help bands. And he said, why don't we start doing this And he kind of floated the idea out there, okay? It's almost as though he was saying there has to be something that Adventists can do to make the world a better place. So the idea just kind of drifted. I don't find any reference to it between this February date and then in early November, November 4, I believe it was, Dr. Kellogg finally, I suppose, he just said, okay, nobody else is doing this. I'm going to push this thing. And so he called a meeting in the sanitarium and brought together a lot of his workers. And he said, listen, folks, we need to start some Christian help bands. Now, that's not a complicated title. What it means is a band of Christians who help people. Okay? It's not complicated. Okay? So we need to start some Christian help bands. He got these together, and they all kind of scratched their heads, and they thought about it. And they voted that first night, and they formed what was ever after known as Christian Help Band Number One. Okay? And Christian Help Band Number One was a simple idea. They had a variety of people. They had one leader, and my favorites were the three burden bearers. They were the guys who weren't particularly talented, but they could pack stuff. Okay. They had a nurse. They had some mother's helpers. They had, what else am I missing? They had a Bible worker. And basically, the idea is we're just going to do simple stuff. Now, some of them, of course, were medically trained. And they were in close proximity to the sanitarium, which was an advantage to them. And so they could do maybe a little more, you know, some more, some less, in some different areas. But most of what they did was really simple stuff. Things like firewood. Michigan can get cold in the winter. And if all you've got is a wood stove, it's so much better if you have wood. So firewood, clothing, food, help somebody find a job if they needed a job. They did some medical care. They had people with, you know, sores or broken limbs or something like that, and they would help them out. You could probably didn't have quite the legal concerns that we might have with that today. A couple of times, they actually arranged for someone to have a charity surgery at the sanitarium. I don't know how big of a surgery, what it was, but, you know, they would occasionally make arrangements like that. So basically what they were doing was they were just simply saying, okay, let's find out what these people need and see if we can help them. It's complicated stuff, I know. Okay, a lot of times they just help, you know, clean house. You know, somebody's laid up, they need some help, right? They taught people how to cook more healthful foods. They would, sometimes they taught, they practiced, and they taught simple hydrotherapy, which is a great healing art, okay? They'd help people stop smoking. And as they did all this, they talked. And they often talked about Jesus. And sometimes they might leave a book behind, a Bible or some other book. It was pretty simple stuff. Well, let's see. There was one more thing that happened in 1892 that was important, and that is this. On the 22nd of November, Ellen White's comment that, quotes, "The loud cry of the third angel has already begun in the revelation of the righteousness of Christ," that statement was printed in the Review. Now, from an Adventist history point of view, that's an important statement. The loud cry has already begun. Fascinating. So, in one sense, now that brings us up to our starting point. The 1893 General Conference, okay, 2 years after 1891, 5 years after 1888, okay, so 1888 Kellogg's converted, 1891 they vote to start the orphanage. 2 years later, 1893, okay? This Ministerial Institute and General Conference session, January to March. Elder A.T. Jones presented a 24-part series of studies on the Third Angel's Message, which went from start to finish of that series. That series of messages has been reprinted a number of times, and you may or may not be familiar with it. If you've seen the book, A.T. Jones, you know, 1893, Third Angel's Message. This is that series, okay? But Dr. Kellogg presented a series of 8 talks on medical missionary work given just between February 5 and 15. So his was a shorter duration, only 8 talks. Now, if you wanted to find out what Dr. Kellogg said in those talks, you would normally look in a publication that's known as the General Conference Bulletin. It's basically the minutes of the General Conference meeting, okay? You know how they have the secretary. But they pretty much record almost verbatim everything that goes on at the General Conference, all the motions and whatnot. And this is just how you keep up to date if you didn't happen to be there, okay? So if you wanted to find out what Kellogg said, that's where you would probably go looking. But don't bother, because you won't find it there at all. If you wanted to find what he actually said in his meetings, you would have to track down this publication. This is the Medical Missionary. Now, it was a monthly publication that was printed by the International Health and Temperance Association. It was published by the International Health and Temperance Association. It was printed by the Good Hope Publishing Company in Battle Creek, Michigan. In other words, that was Dr. Kellogg's paper. So how did Dr. Kellogg's General Conference presentations end up in something else? Okay, kind of an interesting story. The only solid evidence we have is from this that was printed on the front page of that. This extra number, the Medical Missionary, and another extra number which will succeed it, comprise an abstract of the addresses pertaining to medical missionary work delivered at the, we would say, recent Seventh-day Adventist General Conference and the institute preceding it, together with the business transacted by the Sanitarium Association and the International Health and Temperance Association and the organization of the Seventh-day Adventist Medical Missionary and Benevolent Association. Okay, so that's interesting. What that says simply is that this has Kellogg's stuff in it, but it doesn't tell us why it's there. We have to read the next paragraph. It says, this number of the extra, and I don't know if you noticed, but back when I had the picture of the masthead, right at the very top it said extra number 1. This was not a normal monthly publication. This was an extra issue, okay? So this number of the extra is made up, except where otherwise stated, of addresses delivered before the Institute and the General Conference by Dr. John Harvey Kellogg. It should be further stated that these extra numbers of the Medical Missionary will be sent to all subscribers to the General Conference Bulletin, which should have contained the same matter. But the funds raised for the publication of the bulletin having been exhausted, the publication of the report of meetings and other matters pertaining to medical missionary and benevolent work was undertaken by the Medical Missionary. Okay, so the explanation is given there that they ran out of cash, so instead of printing this stuff in the bulletin, it was printed in the Medical Missionary. That is nonsense, unfortunately. the General Conference Bulletin is not one big, those of you who are old enough to remember, the big Sears and Roebuck catalog. It didn't come out in one big whomp, okay? It was put out, actually, that particular year, it came out in 26 different publications, you know, from anywhere from about 8 pages to, I think, 32 pages, okay? And 26 different installments coming out, like, every day or every other day all through this series of things. Dr. Kellogg's first presentation should have come out in the 6th of those 26 installments, if under normal circumstances. There is no accountant in the world smart enough to be able to say, we don't have enough money, the only way we can stay on budget is to cut out everything that Kellogg's going to say for the rest of the conference. That wasn't it. For some reason, somebody made an editorial decision, and they just simply said, you know what? Let's not put anything that this guy says into the bulletin. Now, why would they have said that? Why would they have done that? My best guess is that they probably did that because of what he had said 2 years before. Well, what did he said the last time, okay? What could he possibly have said? Well, here's just one example of the kind of thing that he said. In 1891, Dr. Kellogg had been telling the story of health reform within the Adventist Church. And he told how, you know, it first got started in 1863, and it actually took off, and everybody loved it, and it was doing well, and great progress was being made for about 10 years, could almost stretch it to 12 years type of thing. And then people got busy with other topics. This is what Kellogg said. You know, other things came in that attracted the attention, and the young ministers weren't being educated on health reform. And it started to take a nosedive. And so here's the way he described this. There was kind of a backsliding in regards to health matters. He described it like this. The backward movement continued, however, until it seemed almost like a stampede. Men and women who had for years testified to the great benefits received from the adoption of health principles suddenly discovered that health reform did not agree with them, that two meals a day were insufficient to support a working man, especially brain workers who need more nourishment than those who use their muscles only. I mean, hey, I'm using my brain in addition to my muscle. I got to have more food than the poor guy who's out there working hard. They found that good beefsteak was necessary for good health, that good cheese was essential to good digestion, and a cup of strong tea now and then to relieve sick headache, not particularly objectionable, and possibly of service as a preventative. The provision stands and boarding tents at camp meetings ceased to be object lessons for our people and those not of our faith in healthful dietetics. The camp meeting provision stand in the last decade has rarely failed to include in its stock a good supply of lard, crackers, ginger snaps, baker pies and cakes of various sorts, dried beef, smoked halibut, sail codfish, smoked herring, painted candies, and unwholesome knickknacks of various sorts, a good supply of cheese, ripe enough to be buried and lively enough to move on if not kept in a cage, and in the background might usually be seen arranged in a picturesque manner sundry coils of sausage, warranted, however, to be baloney, as I have frequently been told, which is a guarantee that the article is not Simon pure swine's flesh, but a miscellaneous assortment of all manner of beasts. Okay, so people didn't really like him saying stuff like that in 1891. Was he right? Yes, by and large, he was right. Okay, but they didn't like him saying it. And so in 1893, they said, let's just not bother to report anything that he said. Well, that's too bad. What it means is that what Dr. Kellogg said in 1893 has been ignored for more than a century, because it literally got lost track of. So what did he say? Well, he talked about good works. And he used an awful lot of Bible verses. Things like this. Command those who are rich in this present age not to be haughty, nor to trust in uncertain riches, but in the living God who gives us richly all things to enjoy. Let them do good, that they may be rich in good works, ready to give, willing to share, storing up for themselves a good foundation for the time to come, that they may lay hold on eternal life. That the man of God may be complete, thoroughly equipped for every good work. Those who have believed in God should be careful to maintain good works. And let our people also learn to maintain good works to meet urgent needs, that they may not be unfruitful. That he might redeem us from every lawless deed and purify for himself his own special people, zealous for good works. In 1 Corinthians 11, Paul exhorts us, be followers of me even as I also am of Christ, who, Peter tells us, left us an example that you should follow in his footsteps. And in Acts 10, Peter tells us that Christ went about doing good. And this is quoting Dr. Kellogg right here. It is evident then that if we are Christ's servants, if we follow Christ, we must also go about doing good. We are not to wait for the opportunities for doing good to come to us, but we must go about doing good, seeking opportunities to do good, to help the needy, to bless and comfort the sorrowing, to uplift the fallen. We must search them out, not wait for them to hunt us up and move us to action by their appeals. We are not to be narrow in our charities, this is still Kellogg, for Paul says to us in Galatians 6, let us do good unto all men. It is true, he adds, especially unto them who are of the household of faith. But this does not excuse us from doing good to those who are not of the household of faith, for he says all men. And certainly we cannot hide behind this apology, for we have not been good even to those belonging to the household. Who's he talking about? The orphans? The old folks? A lot of the old folks that he was talking about there were actually ministers who had worked for the church. They had no retirement plan in those days. Those are the folks he's talking about. He goes on, for years and years we have been well able to furnish a home for the aged, the infirm, the homeless, for poor widows, worn out ministers, aged pilgrims and helpless children, members of our denomination, old pioneers in the cause who gave liberally of their property in the early days when the work was just beginning, and whose faith in the truths which we profess has led them to put all their earnings into the cause instead of hoarding up a competency for themselves. All these worthy and deserving ones who appeal to us on fraternal as well as humanitarian grounds, we have neglected in a manner which has become a denominational disgrace. Well, put it bluntly, I think it's fair to say Kellogg was a little embarrassed by his church's response to these things. The church at that time seemed to think that health reform, medical missionary work, just about anything else associated with Dr. Kellogg, was, you know, maybe some sort of a nice, pleasant thing that'd be done off to one side if you felt like it. But, you know, Kellogg knew that this was stuff God was calling his people to do. What could he say? What could he do? How do you get people to do what you know they need to be doing if they don't want to do it? It's not a new question. Lots of people face that question. Well, Dr. Kellogg thought that maybe quoting Ellen White would be helpful. Ellen White had written a lot on this topic, and she had some influence that he did not. And so, you know, sometimes you quote an authority. I should mention here that for the next few slides, anything that's in red print is Ellen White's comment, and the black stuff, the black print, is Dr. Kellogg's, okay? Because he's quoting her, going back and forth. I just wanted to try and keep that straight. So it's not there for emphasis particularly, just so you know who's writing and who's quoting and that sort of thing. So Kellogg quotes here. Says, we have seen the widowed mother with her fatherless children working far beyond her strength in order to keep her little ones with her and prevent them from suffering for food and clothing. Many a mother has thus died from overexertion. And Kellogg says, a mother who has the true instincts of self-respect will not go from door to door begging. She will suffer rather than complain. And because people do not complain, because they do not clamor for assistance, we do not stop to think that they may be suffering. We seldom inquire after them. Quoting again, how little has been done by us as a people for this class. Kellogg says, please think of that. This was said 2 years ago. Yeah, it's funny. You know, me, I'm reading history, and this is 120 years ago for me. You know, but he's saying, 2 years ago, and we haven't done anything yet. Well, yeah. How little has been done by us as a people for this class. For mothers, he says, for widowed mothers, have we not come far short of our duty? We are not doing as much as is done by other denominations. Now, I don't say this, Kellogg says, the Lord says it. We have set ourselves up on a high pinnacle and say, we are God's special people. Our cause is the Lord's cause. And we talk about ourselves as being the peculiar people. And yet we are not doing as much Christian work, and Christian work of a very important character, as other denominations are doing. Again, quoting, it is right that more should be expected of us than of others. The Bible teaches us the same thing, that we ought to be doing more than others, but we are doing less. Now, can we expect the loud cry to begin while we are so neglectful of the needy around us. We may imagine that the Lord is going to work miracles for us and to do this work himself, but he will not. We need not expect that the loud cry will begin until we do what the Lord wants us to do. Now, this was the first time Dr. Kellogg had mentioned the loud cry. And it's kind of like he stepped over a line that was just a little too much for someone in the audience. And immediately there was a voice. The loud cry has already begun. And Kellogg responded, "We ought to be able to show that we are doing what the Lord says should be done first." And that was apparently not convincing. The voice says, "It has begun." And I guess in an effort to be tactful, Kellogg said, "Then we shall see this work that the Lord tells us must be done begin right away." Well, he hadn't really gotten to explaining why he felt that yet. He just, this mention of the loud cry just kind of popped up. You know, Kellogg did not work from prepared speeches, okay? Just to give you an illustration of this guy. He wrote 50 books, 50-some books in his life, and he did it while riding a bicycle, okay? He would ride in the morning round and round in circles with his stenographer sitting on a stool in the middle of the circle, and he's dictating this book, and it's like it didn't even need proofreading, okay? The guy was a genius. So when he stands up to talk to a few hundred people, it's not like he's trembling with stage fright and he's all worried about, oh, can I think of anything to say? So he's just kind of talking. And so he mentioned the loud cry without having explained why and how. And that may have thrown people off a little bit. Well, it came back to the question of the loud cry a little bit later. He said this, "Now the question is whether Seventh-day Adventists are going to lead in this work, or is it going to be left for someone else to do? The Lord has given us here a very precious work to do. It is not the whole of the third angel's message, but it is a part of it. You read in Isaiah 58 how we can make our light shine. Quoting, if thou draw thy soul to the hungry and satisfy the afflicted soul, then shall thy light rise in obscurity and thy darkness as the noonday be as the noonday." I don't have time to go through everything that Kellogg said in his presentation. But basically what he said was, the loud cry that it talks about in Revelation 18, if you want to see that in more detail, you can find it in the last part of Isaiah 58. And in the first verse of Isaiah 58. Some people questioned whether Isaiah 58 had anything to do with the loud cry. But you know, the first two words of Isaiah 58, verse 1, cry aloud. sort of sounds like the loud cry. Maybe you have to just kind of flip the two words around, you know? Cry aloud, spare not, lift up thy voice like a trumpet. Show to my people their transgressions and the house of Jacob their sins. What Isaiah 58 says is you're not going to get God's attention through these means, and we're not going to go into all that, but he said, you know, they were fasting, they were afflicting their souls, they were doing all this stuff. They were trying to get God's attention, and they said, you're not paying any attention to us, God. And God says, have I asked for that kind of a fast? Try this. And then he lists off all these things. Deal your bread to the hungry. Clothe the naked, bring the poor that are cast out into your home. Be nice to people. it's so simple, it's pathetic. Be nice to people. And then at the end of the chapter, there's a whole string of promises. And this is what Kellogg's talking about. Then your righteousness will rise in the dark, your health shall spring forth speedily, righteousness of the Lord will go, I got this all mungled up, I'm sorry. The glory of the Lord will go before you, his righteousness will be your rear guard. Then shall he, you'll ride on the high place of the earth, and he'll feed you with heritage of Jacob your father, and I can't remember what the others are. But there's this whole string of promises. And Kellogg's saying, that's the loud cry. This is how your light rises in darkness, in obscurity. He says, you know, Seventh-day Adventists, you know, most of the world doesn't even know we exist. going to have to do something to raise our light. We have to let the light shine. How is that going to happen? Isaiah 58 tells us. Kellogg says, if we want the loud cry, brethren, to begin, brethren, that is the place where it is going to begin. The loud cry is going to begin with our doing the things that the Lord in this chapter says come before the loud cry. So he says we must draw out our soul the hungry and satisfy the afflicted soul. He says if we will do this, our light shall shine. Well, someone in the congregation choked a bit on that. Question, don't you think the loud cry has commenced? Now notice what he said here. I don't know. I am presenting this subject of medical missionary work from my standpoint. There is everything to indicate that the Lord is anxious to have the loud cry begin to sound, but he says these things referred to in Isaiah 58 must first be done, and so far the things that have been done in this direction have been done by other people, not by us. Who are the other people? Oh, Mrs. Haskell, the business guy down in Chicago. He goes on. Of course, A.T. Jones is giving this whole long series, and he's talking about the loud cry. He says this, Brother Jones may be right in thinking that the time has come for the loud cry to begin, but if the loud cry has been begun by our people, it must be because we have just begun to do a little in the way of letting our light shine. But we've done so little in that way that it seems to me that before the loud cry will make any great noise in the world, we'll have to let our light shine a great deal brighter than we have ever yet done, because the works come first. The light must shine through these good works before we can be called the repairers of the breach and the restorer of paths to dwell in. For that promise comes after all these conditions, you see. We had a testimony over 30 years ago saying that we as a people were to rise higher and higher, but it does not appear from testimonies received at different times since that one was given that we have risen perceptibly from that time until now, a period of over 30 years. How is the loud cry going to be given through us when a large part of the denomination are 30 years behind time and sounding a note altogether out of tune? We must do the work which the Lord has told us to do and which we have left undone. We must do our duty in relation to health principles and benevolence in connection with other questions. We must heed the light and accept the whole truth before we can expect the Lord to sound the loud cry through us. Well, this rattled some cages. Because this is now February of 1893, and on November 22, 1892, just 2.5 months before, Ellen White had written that the loud cry had already begun. So was Kellogg disagreeing with Ellen White? Were they on the same page or not? It's a messy little technical detail in the history of things, but notice this. We read this before. This little thing right here is as close as Dr. Kellogg came to getting a handle on that question, at least at this time. It says, if the loud cry has been begun by our people, it must be because we have just begun to do a little in the way of letting our light shine. What had just begun? The orphanage was just finishing being built. They'd started moving the kids in already in February. The visiting nurses program had been up and running for about a year. The Christian Help Bands had been up and running for 3-4 months. Just begun. Now, the amazing thing here in this, historically, when you look at the individuals involved, is that Kellogg never, ever took credit for any of that. And you know, when you read enough about Kellogg, fascinating guy, by the way, but you know, you read enough about Kellogg, it's like he was not completely devoid of ego. Okay. Sometimes he was accused of having maybe a little too much ego, okay? He could have said, guess what, people? The loud cry has finally just now started because we have just now started being nice to people, doing the stuff that Isaiah 58 says needs to happen before the loud cry comes. But he never took credit for that. It's almost like, I don't know, I've tried to figure this out. The church as a whole wasn't getting on board with his projects. And so maybe it's like, how can we say that the Lord is blessing the church as a whole when so many of them aren't even interested in what's going on? Maybe that's how it was. Maybe he was trying to hold out, and he says, you know, these guys aren't giving me any credit for this, and I, you know, maybe there was a little pride issue going on. He says, you know, I'm not going to say anything like that until they, you know, come to me and say, wow, Dr. Kellogg, you guys are really, yeah, you're nailing it, brother. You're doing the right thing. I don't know what it was, but he never did. That's as close as he ever came to explaining how this could actually be working out with Ellen White's comment and all. The problem is that Kellogg had a vision of what the Lord was calling for his people to do in medical mission work, but it's almost like he looked at what he knew was necessary to finish the loud cry and said, we aren't doing that. And so he could hardly bring himself to believe that loud cry had started. You know, but it's like looking at a little thing about that high and saying, it's a mighty oak tree. Well, not yet, but it's on its way, you know. He seems to have never grasped the idea that it could have just begun. Okay, got to move on. Sorry about that. I'm taking too long with this. Okay, notice what Ellen White had said, though. Has already begun in the revelation. Okay? This is the beginning of the light. It actually fits. Let's go on. Notice this word here. Ellen White did not say the proclamation of the righteousness of Christ. There's a big difference between proclamation and revelation. Let's go on. Notice what she had said here in her statement. This is the beginning of the loud cry, or the light of the angel, whose glory shall fill the whole earth. There is an interesting parallel between that and this comment here. We shall see the medical missionary work broadening and deepening at every point of its progress until the whole earth is covered as the waters cover the sea. She's quoting two of the minor prophets, actually, say that same thing, but it's the glory of the Lord covers the earth as the waters cover the sea. There's a pretty strong hint of a connection there. Let's go on. Notice this comment. I want to tell you that when the gospel ministers and medical missionary workers are not united, there is placed on our churches the worst evil that can be placed there. Notice who suffers. It doesn't say a word about the doctors. They seem to get off scot-free. You know? It's the worst evil that can come to the church when these two things are not united. Our medical missionaries ought to be interested in the work of our conferences, and our conference workers ought to be as much interested in the work of our medical missionaries. This thing has to be brought together. What would that mean, you know, for us today? How do we do that? Is it a crossing of boundaries, kind of an overlapping of interests, you know? What if the truths of the third angel's message were united with practical ministry to the well-being, the simple well-being, physical, mental, whatever it takes, you know, of all with whom we come in contact? What if everyone interested in righteousness by faith, and this has been a hot topic for years within the Adventist Church, I mean, you know, it's gone back and forth, and what if everybody interested in righteousness by faith learned how to blend it with hydrotherapy and massage? You know, what would happen then? What if there's a group, some of you may be familiar with, some maybe not, but it's a group known as the 1888 Message Study Committee. And their whole focus is that general conference session back then. What if that group got together with the Adventist Medical Evangelistic Network? What would that do? Could that ignite the loud cry? There's one more link between 1888 and medical mission work. These are the only two issues on which Ellen White felt it would be proper to bypass or even abandon the organizational structure of the denomination if absolutely necessary. that may not sound like much, but when you consider the, all the work for 20-some years that James and Ellen White put into trying to get the church organized, she was not going to bypass that organization lightly. There are only two topics on which she ever even hints at that. One was 1888. Do I have that on screen? I don't know if I have that here. In Minneapolis, in 1888, she said, if the ministers will not receive the light, I want to give the people a chance. Perhaps they may receive it. And to be honest, that's pretty much what happened. The ministers were not accepting what was being given at that point. And for the next year and a half, she spent her time traveling around to churches. Similarly, she said that medical missionary work needed to be done, even if it be over the heads of ministers and president of the conference. This is an important enough thing. She says, you can trash the chain of command if you have to. So here's a simple take-home thought from what we've seen so far. Dr. Kellogg was a fallible human. You know, I wish he didn't say some of the things he'd said and the way he said them. In years later, he certainly went far astray and left the Lord, 15 years down the road. But maybe, just maybe, he was on to something back in 1893. That's an important thought. Let's have our closing hymn. And now I need to explain a thing about this. The closing hymn is